Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Bog. We were going to do a show about transhumanism, but it required Andre to be present, and unfortunately, he's having some technical difficulties. So we're going to switch it up, and we're going to talk about a topic that I talked about on the Bizarrecast earlier today. So we are going to rehash some of those things and talk about it with you guys, talk about it with the Bog Lords, about something that a lot of us are really into. And I know there's something that it's just hand in hand that goes in with the heathen community and our heathen culture, our modern heathen culture. And that's fiction, right? We love fiction. We love fiction. We love games. We love certain types of music. We like certain themes. And a lot of these themes, we share our interest in. And unfortunately, a lot of these themes have been trivialized as of late, as of recent, by the mainstream publishers, mainstream creators, and all this kind of stuff. And we're about to get into all of that and talk about all of that. But we're going to start with our plugs first. If you like The Bog, you support The Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/The Bog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You get a mug, you can get a sticker, and most importantly, you get RSS feeds so you can listen to the audio of every single show that we do in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. That is patreon.com/The Bog. If you support The Bog another way, you can go to shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop and check out some sweet Bog merch. Winter is coming. Get yourself a Bog beanie. Get yourself a Bog hoodie. All kinds of good stuff, man. I got one of our boys just got a Bog hoodie and sent us some pictures. Really, really great stuff. Made in America, a lot of it. So go check out shop.spreadshirt.com/BogShop and get yourself some sweet merch. If you want to support one of our friends, make sure you go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. IronAgeJodish. Facebook.com/IronAgeJodish for some authentic, ancient, Vedic astrology. Our boy Neil John is so smart. Dude, just go check it out. Go give him a like. And if you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. And the Bizarrecives, Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines. Yours truly is the editor-in-chief of this project. And we have knocked it out of the park with our sales. Thank you so much to each and every one of you guys. I know, man, when the Bog Lords get called, man, they come out in force. And you guys, thanks to you guys, the Bizarrecives has become a legitimate contender for Weird Tale compilation type books. And we are quickly becoming a legitimate publishing operation because of you guys. Thank you so much. If you haven't gotten your copy of the Bizarrecives Issue 1, you better get it, because Bizarrecives Issue 2 and several other publications are on their way. Go to thebizarrecives.com and click on the image of the cover, and it will take you to Amazon. If you hate Amazon, go over to Books A Million. We're on Books A Million and several other places as well, the Bizarrecives. So, Tristan, how are we doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. So I'm very interested in what we have today. Why don't you tell me, what is the problem with modern fiction as you see it?
So the problem with modern fiction, well, you also have to kind of compartmentalize it, right? There's different problems that occur in different genres. But it all pretty much stems from kind of, how can I put it? Okay, so let's start by breaking down the kinds of the problems that are in the genres, and then we can kind of bring it back, and we'll talk, because it all kind of comes from the same thing. We talk about fantasy. Everybody loves fantasy, right? I love fantasy. Tristan loves fantasy. Me, Tristan, and Andre, quite a few times have gone off the rails and yakked about fantasy. You know, these guys do a Boghammer 40K, which is, they talk about Warhammer 40K lore and all kinds of stuff. There's,
well, as you put it once, is there any fantasy setting that you don't have an autistic knowledge of?
Yeah.
And then the answer is no.
Yeah. Tristan is insane. He has forgotten more about fiction settings than most people will learn in their entire lifetimes. He's a nut, and he's exactly the guy to talk about this with. But when we talk about fantasy, for example, fantasy comes down to the problem of poor epistemology. And by that, I mean modern fantasy writers, they build off of previous fantasy works. Okay, so let's take a step back and look at who were the founders of the fantasy genre.
Tolkien. So let's say like kind of how most fantasy descends from Tolkien in the modern day.
Yeah. Tolkien, Robert E. Howard, Jack Vance, these kinds of guys. C.S. Lewis deserves to be mentioned in that conversation. These guys, when they were world building, when they were creating their worlds, when they were creating their settings, they were drawing directly from source material, right? They were drawing directly from historical documents, study of material culture. Actually, Robert E. Howard said that he would have written historical fiction if it didn't take so much time. So he had to write Sword and Sorcery because it took less work to write Sword and Sorcery. But anyway, these guys were drawing directly from historical source material, studying of material culture, theology, culture, political understandings of the ancient world, whatever you could think of. They studied the ancient world and used source documents to create and build an immersive, believable fantasy setting, right? So what happened after that was these guys inspired the entire second generation of fantasy writers. You know, this is where you get your guys like Robert Jordan, Eric Vale, or what, I can't remember his name, Erickson.
Most of the classic fantasy authors that we're all familiar with, all the very famous huge names that made it big and made the millions.
Yeah. And then after that, you started to get a lot of fantasy books that were based off of things like D&D settings, right? You get your Dragonlance, you get your Icewind Dale saga, you get Elminster, Dark Elf trilogy, guys like Ed Greenwood and R.A. Salvatore and Tracy Hickman, Margaret Weis, so on and so forth, right? And then you now are getting the next generation of these fantasy writers, and they're like four generations removed from the historical documents. So now we're starting to see them effectively kind of create anime characters and these worlds that are completely just alien to what we would envision a medieval fantasy world would look like, or a medieval world period. And some people say, well, it's fantasy, it's not fiction. Anybody that makes that argument that it doesn't matter because fantasy, they deserve to get smacked in the lips. Because,
you know what? I mean, in a technical sense, they're not even wrong that fantasy could theoretically be whatever you want, but that isn't really what people want and are expecting when you say, here, I've got this fantasy setting. What that means is very specific. It's basically the Tolkien model, that this is a world built based on Northern Germanic mythology, set in Europe with a medieval setting, with vaguely historical and realistic technology and sociological worldviews. And that's what everyone wants and expects when you say a fantasy setting.
Yeah, exactly. And one that kind of, now this isn't an endorsement of the guy. Tristan actually really likes him. I don't like him at all. I think I don't like his style of writing. I don't like the series, and I especially don't like him personally. George Martin. He actually, to give the devil his due, did a very good job of building a realistic, immersive, kind of believable, coherent world. In that it wasn't Seattle with elves with umpteen thousand different fantasy races, and they were all commingling together with this like vague presupposition of liberalism, and there's these metro cities where, you know, elves are breeding with orcs, or breeding with goblins, or breeding with demon spawn, or breeding. You know, I mean, it's not like that. It's this believable world where there are houses and there are different factions of people, and there's struggle, and there's hatred and blood feuds and resentment and like betrayal and like all this kind of stuff that actually happens when properly demonstrating or observing the human condition. Would you say that's an accurate assessment?
I mean, I would say that's a perfectly accurate assessment, Dave, and I think that actually goes to the heart of what some people want to have an issue with George Martin, and actually what I find the most beneficial of his writing at all. You see, people take from the idea that he is himself basically like a social democratic liberal soy kind of guy, right? And basically what happens from that perspective is that they assume that his work must also then be filled with these liberal narratives and beliefs and end goals. And really they're not, because what Martin did when he was writing his work was to create a setting that was composed of what's called deliberate values dissonance, which is that he was presenting a very realistic world medieval setting because he thinks that this is terrible and abominable and terrifying. And he doesn't actually have to change anything because the reason it's so terrifying is that it's extremely realistic. It's effectively how the medieval world really was. But if you don't accept the liberal narrative and skew of perspective and go with like a more traditionalist perspective that says, yeah, feudalism is pretty cool and maybe we should have patriarchy and a hierarchy and, you know, order in our society. When you look at a realistic medieval setting where people have knights who want to have honor and go to war and you don't think that's terrible, well, it is effectively just that. It's a deliberate values dissonance, but my own values are much more aligned to the values of the in-character, or the in-setting characters than they are George Martin himself. And all you have to do is just ignore the fact that the author wasn't intending it to be read like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like George Martin wrote the opposite of what he thought was good, and that turned out to be what is actually good.
I mean, that is more or less exactly what's going on here. He wrote medieval characters reacting realistically to a medieval setting, and medieval Tristan is like, yeah, that's great.
So, like I said, I'm not a fan of it. I don't like his writing style. I don't really, it ain't me. I just don't like it. I think he's dry and boring, I don't want to get into all that and talk about George Martin, but effectively the main point I was getting at was the reason that George Martin got the success that he did and got backed by HBO and got a whole series done of his books in a time where novels don't sell. Like, you could go type in Google death of the novel and you will find a dozen articles pointing at sales analytics and data pointing to that novels are going the way of the dodo bird, at least for now, at least in this era. And that small.
I mean, it really does seem so. I remember reading once that the average fantasy book, or any book really, sells less than 500 copies. And that's considered a very successful moderate showcase for any sort of modern novel put out in today.
So, wait, that's considered successful, 500?
Yeah, that's considered like the average successful book. It's not even like that totally fell on its face. That's like, yeah, you did all right. You're pretty good.
Yeah, and that's being published, right? That's being published.
Yeah, that's being published from like fully formal mainstream publishers, Penguin, Tor, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the numbers for self-publishing and indie publishing are actually much more abysmal. The average self-published or indie published title sells about 100 to 150, 200 copies in its first year. That's the truth. And with Bizarchives, let me bring this up. Bizarchives has sold over 500 copies in its first 3-4 months. So that's, you know, we really knocked it out of the park. Not only did we quadruple the sales for the entire year in our first few months, we're blowing out industry-backed, you know, books. So
right, so that's definitely got to be like maybe the top 10 or 20% of published material ever put out in the modern world at this point.
Yeah, it's well, the, you know, it all really depends on, you know, the platform, right? Because you got to keep in mind, when it comes to self-publishing and indie publishing, these guys don't have a platform. There's usually just some guy that wrote a book and puts it up there and like maybe shares it on his Facebook. Like, the overwhelming majority of people that publish, self-publish and indie publish, they like sell like 10 copies. Like, they just sell to their fam. You know,
I mean, most people who are capable of self-publishing a book are not also people who are capable of marketing their own work. That's sort of the stickler there.
Yeah, so you got to think that when Tristan says top Bizarchives top 10%, the reason for that is because 70% sell next to nothing. Yeah, I mean there's the overwhelming majority of self-published books on Amazon and Ingram Spark and Lulu and so on and so forth sell less than like don't like in the entire life.
Probably less than 100 in their entire thing.
Yeah, in the entire lifetime of the book, they sell less than 100. So we were blessed that we have the Bog Lords and that we have you know what I mean. We have lots of friends that promoted and stuff like that. We like really knocked it out of the park. But anyways, back to the problem with fiction is also, you know, speaking of industry, is effectively the industry itself. You have a handful of industry darlings, i.e. your Dean Koontzes and your Stephen Kings and, you know, all of these kind of folks that the moment their name goes on anything, the industry goes nuts, spends half of their budget, pumps it into every single bookstore on the planet, and like that's it. And like I can't remember what it was like in the UK when Stephen King's It came out, it like they right away printed like 10 million copies. Like 10 million in the UK. Are there even 10 million people in the UK?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's literally a third of their population.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not even joking.
Yeah, that's crazy. Can you think about that? There's, I don't even know if that many people in the UK like read Stephen King's genre of stuff. You know what I mean? So that's the kind of backing that these few, this handful of industry darlings really, really get. And then it's not like what it used to be where you know, I talk about, you know, Pulp Fiction a lot. Back in the days of the Pulp Fiction era, outside of, yeah, you had your industry darlings, but the industry darlings were completely at the mercy of the consumer base, which was the people. So they didn't do well. They didn't have that kind of money, that kind of institutional power that could do that, like we were talking about now back then. So it was literally, we're at the mercy of the market, at the mercy of the consumer base, at the mercy of the people. And they wanted to read.
Well, I mean, to be fair, when they were coming out with that sort of thing, they also didn't have any sort of competition from, you know, TV or internet or that sort of thing. I mean, they have radio, but that was pretty much it.
That is also true. They did not have other mediums that were competing for people's attention. Obviously, a printed book is pretty underqualified to.
In this modern age, most people don't have their primary means of entertainment go to printed media. In, you know, they come home from work, they sit in front of a couch, plop down, and watch whatever's on TV. You know, that it's kind of. I won't even say it's sad because it's just the state of the affairs. I mean, there's nothing really we could do about that. It's just what it is.
But the what's interesting, though, is that over the last 10 years, the printed medium, the book, has actually been rising. People are buying more books now than they were 10, 15 years ago. And a lot of this gets contributed to the millennial generation, you know, getting older and having more money. And because the millennial generation are literally the last generation that grew up with printed medium as their primary mode of entertainment, right? Outside of like Saturday morning cartoons and like Super Nintendo when you were or Nintendo when you were allowed to play it or your Game Boy, you had to read books. You read books. You read comic books. Yeah, we did. If you are like, you know, 30, I don't know, let's say like 32 to 40, you grew up reading books. It's just the way that it is. So now that my generation is older and we have more disposable income because we are, you know, we're at the age where we have the most disposable income, we're buying books and that's being reflected in the sales. So there is this uptick in book sales. And also here's the thing, the printed medium will never go away. It's one of the. It's like there's people saying that someday there will never be books ever again, and that's just not true. There's just some things that will never ever go away that are just tried and true, and it's like saying that someday there was never going to be a need for channel locks because there's so many other different types of tools that do the same thing that are you know battery powered or air powered or like, you know, whatever. But the bottom line is, you know, you got channel locks, you got a wrench, you got a screwdriver. You know, screwdriver is always going to be a thing. You can't get rid of the screwdriver. That's just the way that it is. Doesn't matter how many drill guns you come out with. You know what I mean? The screwdriver is always going to be just tried and true. Same thing with books. You know, books, everybody is always going to like to have at least a few printed books that they can open and reference whenever they want. They can read it. They can experience it. It's a things that are tangible will forever beat things that are digital as far as value.
Well, I mean, you know, as it goes for the different mediums here, I was just having a conversation a few weeks back with my buddy Shivnaz, and we were discussing about how there are really three different types of medium here that have works. You could go with a book, which is, it doesn't have any sort of direct engagement, but it's very long, very detailed. You can really pack a lot of content into it. Then you have comics, which is kind of like a medium thing. You know, there's lots of pictures, artwork, and everything, but there's not that much room for dialogue or narration or anything of that. And then you have movies, which you can't really pack a whole lot of content in them. They're only 2, maybe 3 hours long at the very end of that, but it's very engaging. There's lots of lights, sounds, it's direct action, you see people moving around, and that's really the three different types of medium. But my argument was really disparaging a comic and manga setup here, because I think it's really an inferior option. I think there's always going to be a justification to choose either books or movies, depending on what you're really looking for. But you see, that leaves the middle between, like, comics and manga, where they don't really have a good option between them. I don't really see why you would choose that as your media of choice, when you always have a better option depending on what you're looking for in one or the other.
Yeah, well, Hollywood is hemorrhaging money right now. And it's not just because of COVID. Over the last, you know, 20 or so years, movie theaters and big box office movies are like hemorrhaging money. Actually, who was this? I was reading. Somebody was saying they predict in 30 years the movie industry will be completely gone and replaced by streaming. Like movie theaters will only play.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big issue because especially like people of my age, we grew up in a time where, you know, by the time I was a teenager, if I wanted to watch a movie or get any sort of digital content, I definitely knew where to find it on my C's. And it's just a better option. Why would you go out and pay $60 to go to a movie theater with overpriced popcorn and soda when you can just do the same thing from your living room?
Yeah. We didn't have that. You know what I mean? In my school, I remember we were the first class to have computers. We were the first year to have computer class. I remember them unpacking the computers. They were like these old green screen Macintosh thingamajigs, right? So we still had movie theaters. We went to go see, like, if something came out, you had to go to the movie theater. And that's not there anymore. You could literally just pirate anything, stream anything. Now it's like the movies are going straight to things like HBO Max and stuff like that. There's movie theaters are on their way out, unfortunately, because I like going to the movies. I like especially drive-in movie theaters. We have like two or three of them that are left alive here where I live, and it's just like a really cool thing to go with your family and put the speaker in your car and like all that kind of stuff. But going back to the problem with modern fiction is that when we're talking about the print form, because there is this huge, what would be the word for it? This huge disparity between indie publishers and you know, grassroots creators and, you know, self-publishers, and then the industry darlings. The guys that are in between that are trying to become darlings, they are the ones that dominate kind of the market, and not in a good way. They end up creating a lot of crap. They write things that they think people are just going to like. They go along with the outrage mob and woke culture and like all this kind of stuff. And as a result, they write a bunch of meaningless garbage. And we see this not just in books and stories and stuff like that. And I'm not talking about my indie brothers out there that are self-published and indie writers and publishers. You guys are out of this equation. I'm talking about the guys that are below the industry darlings but are still in the mainstream. And we especially see this in tabletop role-playing games. Tabletop role-playing games, whether people know it or not, are huge influencers and players in the the art form of fantasy literature and science fiction literature. So these guys are doing all this woke garbage trying to appease the outrage mob that don't even like really like these things, right? Like,
I mean, it's the perennial get woke, go broke situation.
Yeah.
And especially in the print media community, it's become a serious issue because they've just infiltrated and taken over all of the awards programs, anything that would recognize up and coming authors. They won't give the awards to any sort of traditional fantasy setting, anything that is normal, masculine, heroic norms. And what they do give it is they go out of their way to give it to what is effectively just diversity representation.
Yeah.
Where the book isn't really good, but it was about like a queer Xeno black person, whatever.
Yeah, that is absolutely a huge problem. I actually read there was one of my buddies that's in the indie publishing sphere was at one of these like sci-fi conventions where they give out awards and everything like that, and the judges were so like butt mad about a lot of the guys that were putting in. One of them was, what's his name? He's like the he's a pretty well known Vox Day. Is that his name?
He's very popular.
Yeah, apparently he does fiction and science fiction kind of stuff. And I guess some publishers that were out of his camp were up for awards, and the judges were so butthurt about this that they went and they created. I forget the word. They came up with this really silly name, like the Compassion Committee or something really dumb. And they ended up giving the award to Zoe Quinn, who wrote a book about sexism in gaming. It wasn't even a science fiction book. It wasn't even a fiction book. This is the kind of ridiculous nonsense that goes on with this stuff. So,
I mean, you know, on the polar opposite end of that, also, just to bring it back to George Martin. He recently headed the Hugo Awards and was himself canceled because he didn't pronounce someone's name correctly. Like, that's how insane it's gotten in these award ceremonies.
We need to come up with our own. That's going to be something that we're going to do. I've been actually thinking about that for a while, doing an award ceremony for authors and kind of just like get a big pile. Doesn't matter how much you sold, how much whatever. We get a committee together to read these books and vote on them and give out awards to people that deserve it, that wrote good, traditional, badass fiction works. Because fiction is important, man. Fiction is, it's, as I say all the time, it is an extension. It is the son of the storytelling tradition of our ancestors. Obviously, you know, Lord of the Rings and Conan are a little bit different than Beowulf and the Odyssey and the Iliad. They're a little bit different, but that's our version of that. You know what I mean? That's our continuation of it. And that's what we understand and appeals to us and speaks our language. And, you know, so it's important that we award and we recognize the people that contribute to this tradition, because weird fiction, pulp fiction, fantasy and science fiction and all of these genres that we love, this is folk art. These are folk art.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you here. It's very relevant to imagine that the works of traditional fiction that everyone is used to in, you know, 10 or 20 years ago isn't just kind of influenced by like the myths of our forefathers. It was explicitly based upon them and used them as the foundation of what they were. That was what they read as the only sort of art that ever existed before we came out with things like the novel.
Yeah, exactly. So, moving over to science fiction. Now, science fiction is something that has the same kind of trouble insofar as it has a lack of epistemology. It is literally just a kind of like fetish, a liberal fetish power fantasy for liberal humanists to create a world where there's all these aliens and everything and everybody gets along and it's hunky-dory and harmonious. When,
I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's a power fantasy where they get to say that they won and this is what the world would be like. It isn't it so awesome?
Yeah, and it completely misses the mark of what science fiction is about. Now, there's a few different genres when we're talking about science fiction, you have your Sword and Planet kind of stuff where you go out into space and conquer and explore and do all that kind of stuff.
Oh, like a space opera.
Well, and then you also have a space opera, which would be like Dune and Star Wars, which is effectively an epic fantasy in space, right? It's not, it's man versus man instead of traditional science fiction, which is man versus technology. Now, if you go and you read the original incarnations of science fiction, guys like H.G. Wells and Jules Verne, and even guys like L. Ron Hubbard, and like there's so many original like science fiction. Now, a lot of this is considered like hard sci-fi now, and then even like Isaac Asimov to some degree. Not so much because he got into like the hippy dippy everybody get along crap when he started writing Foundation, but which is also sort of considered a space opera. But it literally just becomes a liberal humanist power fantasy of coexist, and that's just not the case.
Well, I mean, you know what you need for the primary foundation of a fictional novel is some sort of conflict. And if the entire basis of your setting is that everything is great now and we all coexist, there can't be any sort of conflict.
Yeah. Yeah. I read a lot of indie works, and sometimes I take a step over into the sphere of woke retards, and I see what they're writing. And let me tell you, the stuff that they write is just trash. It's literally trash. I read a sword and sorcery book. It was called like socially conscious sword and sorcery. It was some like really stupid name. And
I don't even know what's in it, and it already sounds awful.
It's horrible. There was no violence in it. There was a very graphic, disgusting sex scene in it. It was just like nothing. And then I read this one. It was called Feminist Heroic Fantasy. And it was cruelty-free feminist heroic fantasy, and it was about this powerful warrior woman that goes and goes to this evil white man and who is oppressing the local indigenous people and convinces him to go away. Like, that was the whole story. And it's like, these are just these things that these people create are just horrible.
So, I mean, very clearly self-insert power fantasies. They wish that this is what they could do.
Yeah. And it's and this goes to, speaking of there's no conflict, these people, these like liberal progressives, they cannot envision a proper villain. They can't manifest a villain because they don't believe in evil. They don't believe in evil. They don't know what evil looks like. To them, bad guys and evil and all that stuff is long gone. It's over. And instead of like, they're like the opposite of what we believe. Like, we believe that the good times, the best times, were in the past and we are now degenerating. They believe the opposite, that the worst times were in the past and now we're on the rise. So they think that evil is behind us. So they can't...
Well, you know what? I don't even think it's necessarily a problem with evil itself, because this was the same issue with the modern Star Wars sequels. They can't write a compelling villain because in order to write an intimidating villain that presents any sort of meaningful challenge, you have to make your villain strong and competent and intelligent and successful and intimidating. But the only way they ever actually write villains are as self-inserts for like their ideological enemies.
Yeah.
So they don't want to present their ideological enemies as intelligent and competent and strong and scary. They want to present them as like weak and pathetic and like meek and helpless and these people who are like man children, right?
Yeah.
But man children are not compelling enemies that you can structure a work around as your villain. So it completely falls flat.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was about to say. The only type of villain that they can visualize, that they can let themselves visualize, is effectively an impotent white guy who's like beliefs are long gone, and there's no limit to his cruelty, and there's like nothing likable about him. He's just there. He's the character of their political opponents, or their perceived.
Opponents. You know, that's probably another issue. There is that there's a longstanding moral idea that conservatives fundamentally have five different moral foundations. Maybe you've ever heard of this idea before. Effectively, it's like care, fairness, loyalty, authority, and purity. But liberals, they don't actually have these five foundations. They only have two of them, care and fairness. So what tends to happen is that liberals literally can't empathize with what conservatives are feeling or thinking. So when they look at a conservative telling you their opinion or doing an action, their only response to be able to like rationalize and process what's going on is that this person is evil or they're intending some sort of malice. So if you fundamentally can't empathize with anyone that's different than you, you really can't construct any sort of actual realistic character or villain or scenarios because you can't process what is going on in their head.
Yeah, exactly. I very much, when I write a villain, you guys will see, I know a lot of my writing isn't in print quite yet. In Bizarchives 2, you'll see I have two stories in there, and you'll get to see some. I put myself into the villains as much as I do with the heroes because I want them to be realistic, and I give them a mixture of my good traits as well as my bad traits. And it's just something that I also think that it's important for a villain to have a compelling argument. Like for example, Fulsa Doom in the Conan movie, when he goes on his thing talking to Conan, he's like, you know, steel is not strong, boy. Flesh is stronger. What is a sword but the hand that wields it? And you're like, he's got a point. You know what I mean? Because that's an important thing, that a villain is convincing and he has a point. And do you know in the back of your head that this is the bad guy, but people that don't understand that he's the bad guy are going to look at him and be like, hey, he's making some sense here. Like, what is really the riddle of steel? The riddle of steel must be that it's flesh, that a sword is nothing but a tool and everything is about he who wields it. Right? That makes perfect logical sense. So to me, it's important that villains not necessarily are likable, but are compelling, and they have a compelling position. What do you think about that, Tristan?
I mean, I think that's exactly right on the money. Any sort of villain or any sort of obstacle needs to be absolutely realistic and compelling, and they don't necessarily need to be right. Like, your hero can present a better option going forward, you know, something that ultimately takes what the villain has said and goes beyond it, right? That's why the villain is the hero is ultimately the correct person in the arrangement. But the villain needs to be someone who you could see as having, yeah, I believe this person would have come up with this scenario and they could convince other people of this.
Yeah, exactly. And this kind of goes into a discussion that we've had several times of the idea of the anti-hero versus the hero dichotomy, which Tristan has described as not a real dichotomy. It's a false dichotomy. And the apple pie, perfect, clean hero is a failure in storytelling. It's not even a real thing.
I mean, I pretty much go exactly with that. Any sort of hero that's effectively only heroic and doesn't have any sort of negative downsides is not a realistic character. It's effectively just like an archetype or a 2D representation of goodness. Any sort of realistic setting and characterization of any sort of these people, you really do need what effectively amounts to an anti-hero. Any hero should have negative attributes, things they need to overcome, obstacles within themselves and others that they need to deal with effectively. And that doesn't mean your hero needs to be extremely dark. Like, there's definitely a spectrum here between really dark anti-heroes and like more light people that are ultimately down the path of heroism without much of a struggle there.
Yeah.
But I think that's mostly the issue of anti-heroes isn't really an issue of good or evil. It's mostly an issue of what is goodness worth? Like, is it all right to do, you know, really heinous things in service of good? That is the primary question of an anti-hero.
Yeah, it's like the thing that we talk about when we play tabletop games. Lawful good doesn't mean lawful nice. You know, I mean, this is there's this correlation between that modernists have between goodness and niceness. And this is something that they create into their heroes. The heroes are always compassionate, always nice, and never mean, and never this or that. And it's just not the case. And I like dark heroes. I think dark heroes are the best kinds of heroes because I like to create good outcomes by any means necessary. And you guys.
Yeah, I mean, my preference is very much for a dark fantasy with a very dark anti-hero who is willing to do very heinous things.
Wait, what's that?
Or I was just saying a dark anti-hero who is willing to do very heinous things. That's basically my preference.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. But I don't mind heroes that are lighter. I love, you know, I mean, for example, people will point at Aragorn as being the archetype of the ultimate good, king of kings, and blah 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 blah. And that's just not the case, dude. Aragorn did some lousy stuff. Aragorn was kind of he was reluctant about his birthright. He was kind of a little bitch at times. He's there's times that he questions, seconds guesses himself. There's inner struggle there. He's got struggle within his love life and his duties and his destiny. And he's not Superman. He is a imperfect man, right? And this is something that we see in all of the heroes. And go all the way back. Odysseus. Is Odysseus a super good guy? No. Odysseus is.
I mean. It's worth noting that the Romans actually hated Odysseus and thought this was the exact, this is one of the reasons why the Greeks were inferior to Romans, because they had heroes like Odysseus, who's just a lying, cheating coward.
Yeah, and he did, the thing where he makes all of his, the harpies or the sirens or whatever show up, and he makes all of them cover their eyes or their ears or something so that they don't hear the song. And then he just orders them to tie him to the mast so he can enjoy their beautiful song, but also not get in trouble. He just did that just to flex, just because he wanted to do it. It had no purpose. And that's just that's part of the, because Odysseus is just an alpha male. He's just an uncaged alpha male that sometimes does things for pleasure.
That goes back to the classical notion of heroism, that a hero is someone who transcends the state of man. So Odysseus transcends the state of man by wanting, having that urge and the curiosity to seek out the siren song when other men would have been frightened away from it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another thing about, Tristan said, the hero transcends the state of man and the rules and the things. He is, as Nietzsche called, the Übermensch, right? He's the overman. So he's above all that stuff. So why, they don't have this. They have that everybody must obey the same laws and same rules as everybody else, complete egalitarianism. And ancient societies understood the heroes, especially mythic heroes, were above this. They could do whatever they want for the most part, except for obviously really, really horrible things. It's really egregious morally,
So the primary foundation of the hero is that they're effectively God on Earth, which is why in classical times, the hero and the demigod were effectively synonymous terms, right? The reason they transcend the state of man is because of their connection to the gods. They're fundamentally divine, heavenly beings in our base material world. They don't approach things with the same limits as other men. They can transcend them. They transcend morality, just as the gods can sometimes do things that are terrible and that are bad for humans, but they get to do it because they're deities, right?
Yeah.
The heroes have some of that within themselves. So the only time they really mess up is when they violate the notions of piety themselves, even the laws that the gods are bound by.
Yeah, and this is another reason why progressives can't They don't make compelling heroes either, because they're so ego driven. They are completely just based on their own ego and self-worship that they can't bring themselves to envision an unreachable superior person, right? They can't create that, because in their world superiority doesn't exist, and if it does exist, it's either completely fake and made up and the result of evil doings and scheming, or it's a construct, or it's illusionary, or whatever. They can't do it, and because of that, they have killed the hero. You know what I mean? Look at and now talking about Odysseus, like Tristan has read all of my stories with my character Lucius Lex. I wanted that to be in my stories, to have a hero. Now, obviously, my character Lex is much darker than, say, an Odysseus or an Aragorn or something like this.
I would say he is much darker than Aragorn, but I would say he's actually pretty coterminous with Odysseus. He's just a much more physical, masculine version of Odysseus.
Okay.
Odysseus is like a cunning hero. Lex is very much more of a physical hero. But I would say that their general moral, like, grayness is more or less the same.
Okay. All right, good. Because that's kind of what I was going for. That Lex, and it gets revealed over time that he has some kind of divine lineage. It's unsure what it is. He is a true hero in the sense. And because of that, he is above the law. And he acts above the law sometimes, and sometimes he's cruel, and sometimes he inflicts excessive force just for somebody bad-mouthing him. And there's times that he just, like, he almost comes off as, like, autistic or something and doesn't quite understand social cues or doesn't care about them. He's just interested in getting from point A to point B, and if anything gets into his way, he's going to destroy it. And that's kind of the whole point of the character. And I wanted that to be in there. I wanted to be, if this is a real life realistic Ubermensch in a haunted dark world, and this is how he would behave. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do think you have generally hit that nail on the head there. And of course, I've in the backgrounds of the scene, I've given you advice and, this is how historical things work and that sort of thing, to really showcase heroism and detachment in a sort of medieval-like setting.
Yeah. And that's talking about one of the things that we discussed, because I show all my stories to Tristan, he gives me feedback. And one of the things that he always points out, and this is important to me too, and this is why I bring it to Tristan, because I want to make sure that the world is immersive in the sense that there is believable material culture. Like, should this guy be wearing this armor? Can he afford this kind of armor? Should the house be made out of this? Should this building be made out of this? Is this something that these people would say? Is this something that these people would own? Is this something that is on par with the level of technology that they had? And this is something that gets completely ignored and thrown away with modern fantasy literature, and that you just have everybody walking around in complete shining full plate mail. They're all just wielding gigantic, ridiculous swords that look like Cloud from Final Fantasy VII. It just makes no sense. You have women on horses charging into leading battle. It's crazy.
That really is basically my autism when I create any sort of fictional world, is I really immerse myself in the idea of these are the situations, this is the society they live in. Now I'm going to backtrack what their beliefs and ideas and how they view society must come about based on these material conditions. So, I mean, we have discussions about things like, well, if this and this and this are the case in your society, then your people must believe X, right? So they have to have that in the story. They can't be saying all this other stuff. They have to believe this thing.
Yeah, it's about everything being coherent and everything being in line with epistemology. That's exactly what it's about.
But I mean, then we also have like more mundane details. Like, we went back and forth for like 4 days over, Lex is too big, bro. You got to like narrow him down like a foot.
It was like there's one passage where I said what I said he was three heads taller than somebody.
Right. I was like, man, he can't be like 9 feet tall. We got to narrow this down a little bit.
So we brought it down to, was it one head taller or something like that? So
I think he was like two heads taller or something. He's like almost like 7.5 feet or 8 feet or something like that. He's still huge, but it's within the boundaries of reason.
So yeah, I Tristan helps me out a lot with that kind of stuff, and it's because those things are important to me. Those things are important, and I hope that I do a good job with my writing to kind of set an example of the things that I think will improve writing coming from indie and aspiring fiction writers, to kind of bring it back to its primordial roots and of storytelling and like all this kind of. And I think those things are important. And the folks that do want to check out my writing, I mean, I have his debut, Lex's debut in Bizarre Archives 1, which is called Lex and the Lost Girl. And then I have two more Lex stories coming out in Bizarre Archives 2, which is Lex in the Odd Village and Lex and the Horror of Burnwick Hollows. And then in Bizarre Archives 3, Lex Conquers Hell. And Bizarre Archives 4, Lex and the Trial of the Nagas. And then I have a Lex novella that is in the works called Grim Earth Shall Burn. And you're going to see a whole bunch of new characters, and that's going to be Lex on the big stage. I'm going to try my hand at doing something that's a little bit bigger scope than just like a single hero doing a single little adventure. And I'm doing okay with it, but that's coming out very soon.
Yeah, I mean, I do have to say, Lex is definitely some of my favorite work. I think that'll be a very big thing going forward. You should keep that up.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I hope people like it, and folks have liked it. You know, it's people really, it goes back to the anti-hero thing. People really vibe with him because he doesn't take shit. He's a tough guy. He kind of transcends the laws of man, especially in a world where there is no law and there is no universal law to protect people. And he's kind of the only line of defense for the people in that world, and he behaves accordingly. So I hope people
in an age of in an age assaulted by political correctness, we have left.
Yeah, he does. He does a lot of like Sigma male kind of moves, where I'm not gonna spoil anything, but he doesn't play with thoughts. He does, he patrols a lot, quite a bit.
That was actually part of my advice during the Changeling story. If whenever that you'll publish that one, come out, people will read some of that. I had quite a bit of fun of working out what should happen there.
Yeah, that's called Lex in the Odd Village. I hope folks really like that. That one has a pretty unique antagonist in the story, and a little bit of a twist at the end. And I hope people really like that. And the other stories are pretty straightforward. Lex slays a bunch of monsters, and so it's like I hope people really like it. By the way, Mr. Tristan, we are coming up on an hour. Would you like to close out with anything?
No, I think we covered more or less anything. We're just winging the session for today before we get Andre back next week to talk about transhumanism.
Yeah, we'll get Andre back on next week, and we're going to do our discussion on the heathen position of transhumanism, and me and Tristan are going to have a little bit of a debate slash discussion on it, and see if we could come to a consensus. And I hope folks enjoy that episode, and that's going to be up next week.
So, everyone in the bog, we're going to see how long it takes for Dave to agree with me. I think it'll take like 40 minutes.
No, that's not going to happen at all. It's you are. Yeah, there's quite a few topics that you can like. You can bring me around on. This is one that is just.
You say that now. Everyone, go to the comment section and tell us who do you think's going to win this debate.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. Well, actually, I have not been paying attention to the chat. Let's go hit the chat real quick. Ancestral Weapons wants to know, how do you fellas like cyberpunk? I'm not sure if you're. Oh, the genre, not the video game. The genre of cyberpunk, I think, is brilliant. I was a big fan of Neuromancer. I really like the cyberpunk genre. I think that it is a very good retelling of traditional science fiction themes. As I mentioned before earlier in the show, science fiction is about is about man versus technology. It is very much a Luddite kind of perspective, like what happens when man sacrifices and gives up some of his humanity for comfort, with technological comfort. And Cyberpunk does a brilliant job of rehashing and retelling a very core element of original science fiction, which was kind of lost, because original science fiction, hard sci-fi, was like this. It was, you know, what happens when robots take over? What happens if we do these kinds of horrible experiments? What happens? It was because it was written in a time where technology was starting to come into, like, the nuclear age and coming out of the industrial age and stuff like that. And there was a lot of, you know, well-founded fears about technology and how it could impact the human condition. And cyberpunk is like the next step in that. But right after the original sci-fi that I'm talking about, it kind of went into Star Wars and Star Trek and Dune and like all of this kind of stuff, where it's like space operas and science is great. And then now modern sci-fi is like, it's like technophile stuff. It's literally.
Well, you know, I would say that Dune is very much very different from like Star Wars or Star Trek, and it's definitely like a space opera, but it has more of a cyberpunk component there to it, where technology is not considered to be the essence of man or our great savior. In fact, they had the Butlerian Jihad, yeah, where we destroyed the thinking machines forever.
Yeah. That is a particle of original science fiction that was in Dune. Dune is a space opera, but it did maintain some of I think Dune was a better version of Foundation. I think Foundation as a series blows, and I think the world building is excellent and the writing is excellent. But as far as like the core philosophies of Foundation are fake and gay, and I think that,
you know,
go ahead.
Dune is ultimately more of a science fantasy than it is a science fiction, because it's more on a level with like Warhammer 40,000 than it is Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah. But my main point was that after, like, because original sci-fi was very earthbound. It was very hard. It was very contemporary. It didn't really get into, like, you know, far-flung futures out in the middle of space and all this kind of stuff. It had to do with our reality here and now, or our reality tomorrow. And I think cyberpunk does a really good job of being the heir of that. Also in the chat, for true sci-fi, see Blade Runner. Speaking of cyberpunk, Blade Runner is probably the best cyberpunk movie that there's ever been. And I even like the sequel that came out. Ancestral Weapon says, Dave Martell, if you haven't seen Ghost in the Shell from 1995, do yourself a favor, my guy. Well, Mr. Ancestor Weapons, like, how am I going to miss Ghost in the Shell? Come on, dog. It's like, yo, you ever hear of Lord of the Rings?
Well, I don't know. We've been over before that Dave's impression of anime is, you know, we got your Pokemans and your tough guys and your fighting machines, and that's the three genres.
Yeah, that is. And Ghost in the Shell is not Japanime. Ghost in the Shell is American, so.
That's, is it actually American? I thought the entire time it was just fully Japanese anime.
Nope, it's not. Well, it might have been made in Japan, but it's American. It doesn't count as Japanime.
Okay, so it's definitely not Pokemon. It's transcended the category.
Yeah, it's transcended a category and a nationality. But Ancestral Weapon says he'd call Blade Runner proto-cyberpunk. No, I would actually disagree. I would say Blade Runner is cyberpunk in its purest form. I would not say that it is anything else. I would disagree. But Blade Runner is an excellent movie, and we could split hairs over the genre. I see why you would say it's proto-cyberpunk, because it doesn't have all of like the cybernetic augmentations and all that kind of stuff, like that's present in Neuromancer and some of these other ones. But Candle Goat says the space stuff was cool too, like 2001 Space Odyssey. Oh yeah, brilliant. That's a brilliant film. Yeah, well, I'm not saying the space stuff is bad. I'm just saying that it got away from kind of the original form of science fiction. I love Dune, by the way. I think Dune is brilliant. I love, you know, you said Space Odyssey. I'm a big fan of these kinds of genre. 40K, I love 40K. So I'm not knocking on space operas and sci fantasy. What I'm saying is that the core philosophy of original sci-fi was kind of gotten away from and then came back to with cyberpunk. That's what I was talking about.
Well, anyway, Dave, I do think we have to hard wrap it up here. We can't talk much more. We're hitting pretty much an hour.
Yeah, we're like, oh, we'll probably wrap it up early. You know, since we're just going off the top here last minute because Andre couldn't make it. End up going over time. That's how it always works. So anyway, we will be back next week with our discussion on transhumanism. Everybody, if you like the Bog, you support the Bog, you want to see the Bog keep its lights on, make sure you go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You get a sticker, you can get a mug, all kinds of stuff, but you can most importantly get the RSS feed so you can listen to the audio of every single show that we do in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. That is patreon.com/thebog. You can also support us another way by going to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and pick up some cool winter merch, hoodies, beanies, all that stuff. shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. You want to support a friend of ours, make sure you go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. We got to get Neil John back on up here pretty soon. It's been a while since he's been on, but brilliant, brilliant guy. Excellent work. So go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some of that stuff. And if you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. Tell him Big Dave sent you. Also, guys, Bizarrechives 2 is coming out very, very soon, plus other publications. If you have not gotten your copy of Issue 1 of the Bizarrechives Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines, make sure to go to thebizarrechives.com and click the image, and you can go right over to our Amazon. But if you hate Amazon, you hate their guts, and you want to get it somewhere else, we're also on Books A Million and elsewhere. So just go check it out. The Bizarrechives Weird Tales of Monsters, Magic, and Machines is a compilation of short stories from aspiring weird fiction authors from a lot of heathens, a lot of guys from the U.S., and also about half of them are from the U.K. as well. So a lot of representation from our brothers over across the pond. So go pick up your copy if you love Lovecraft, if you love Robert E. Howard, if you love fantasy and science fiction and cosmic horror and all that stuff, get yourself a copy. You're going to love it. So over there. But anyway, I'll see you guys next week. I'm going to raise a horn to our exalted patrons. That is going to be our good boy, Mr. Corey, and our very own Andre, who unfortunately couldn't be here this evening because of technical difficulties. But I'm going to raise a horn to both of those guys. Also, hail to both of those guys and their wonderful, beautiful families. And many hails and many blessings to each and every one of you Bog Lords out there. I will see you guys all next week. I'll see you guys then.